In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Please be seated while I rearrange my space. In 1862, there was a missionary teacher who was wandering around the area where she was taking the gospel with some companions, and they stumbled upon a funeral. It was a funeral that was being led by some recently emancipated people. They decided that this was a great opportunity for them to see how those people worshiped when nobody really knew they were around. So they stood quietly in the back and watched. And as they watched, the children of the group picked up books and they took them and they walked to the grave and they circled the grave. And they began to sing one of their sacred songs. Now, this is a song that I'm sure you're all familiar with. And I'm just going to tell you right now, when I was in seminary here, I was a candidate for the St. Jude's Choir, but they did away with it my year, so I'm not a singer. But so if you'd like to join in, please feel free. The Children's Sacred Song. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, and Z. Now I know my ABCs. That time to what? Sing with me. Well, first of all, it's interesting because we don't all sing it exactly the same. Some say, won't you sing with me? But some say the older version is, tell me what you think of me. Now, those missionaries watching this group, I can see in my mind's eye their reaction. They were probably standing there with very condescending smiles. And we know, because we have the writings of one of them, Harriet Ware, that she really pitied these poor, poor people because they were so simple and so superstitious that they thought that the alphabet song was a sacred religious song. What she didn't know was that she was the one who had missed the point. Because for those recently enslaved parents and children, the alphabet song was a religious song. It was a song of faith. It was a song that promised freedom to them. They had just come from a time where it was, in most places, against the law for them to learn to read. To even attempt it meant to risk a beating at best, and death at worst. But they knew that alphabet song, that song that had these magic syllables, was a song that could point the way for them. Because once they learned how to read, then they would be able to learn so much more. And for them, one of the most important things was to learn how to read the sacred scriptures, how to read the Bible. Now, yeah, they had learned Bible stories, and I'm sure that most of you know that many of the old spirituals were based on some of the Bible stories that they had learned. But they knew something was missing, because the stories that they were hearing from the Bible were stories carefully selected and mediated through the needs of the enslavers and designed to teach them how God wanted them to keep their place. And that's part of the reason that the enslavers did not want them to read. But this was so important. It was really a holy task for them. And so they risked everything so that even if they couldn't read, there would be a way for their children to learn to read. Now, first of all, I'm really thirsty. Could you bring me my bottle of water? Thank you. Because otherwise I'm not going to be able to talk in a minute. Thank you. Thanks. Now, it's always kind of interesting to me because, as near as I can tell, throughout the history of people of African descent being here in this country, there has been an understanding by many of European descent that we had no value for education, that we didn't take it seriously, that it wasn't really anything that we aspired to. Or even if we did aspire to it, you know, when you're only three-fifths of a human, you probably don't have the higher order thinking abilities to be able to read. We did value it, and still value it today. In our passage from 1 Timothy, we see one of the ways that this understanding of the need to read and to teach found a place in the hearts of those that had been denied that ability. It says, pay close attention to yourself and to your teachings, and continue in these things, for in doing this, you will save both yourselves and your hearers. They knew that somewhere in this, there was a way through faith to freedom. We're celebrating the lives of two women today. Now, how many of you had ever heard of them? Just out of curiosity, I know that you've also celebrated the lives of people like Absalom Jones and others. For how many of you was it the first time you'd heard of any of those people? Well, that's a good thing. The first woman that we are getting ready to that I'm going to talk about. I've lost the little cheat sheet I had. Anyhow, Anna Hayward Cooper was born after the Civil War, or right during the Civil War, I'm sorry. And she was someone who had a great curiosity and who really, really wanted to be able to learn. And she was fortunate enough that she was put in a place where she was allowed to learn. And eventually, she went off to Oberlin College. Now, Oberlin has a very dear place in my heart and in the heart of my family because Oberlin was one of the few schools that really got it, that really tried to help people of color. As a matter of fact, my great-grandfather, who was born in Washington, D.C., and had never lived in the South. He went into the, he served in the Civil War out of the 5th Colored Regiment in Ohio. Anyhow, he was one of those people who was lucky enough to get to go to Oberlin. And he went there because they were teaching black people how to teach. And then the idea was that they would go and teach those who had never been taught. So my grandfather, who'd never lived in the South, went south. I mean, everybody was coming north, and he went to Arkansas. But he went there because he understood that he had been given this gift, a gift that he was called to share, to teach to his children and to other people's children, so that they could also pass that gift along. And just a few years after my great-grandfather left there, Anna Hayward Cooper went. And she got her degree from there and went to Washington, D.C., where she became the principal of a high school. Of course, it was a high school for black children because all of the schools were still segregated, except for Oberlin. And she went there, and she poured everything she had into making sure that the students under her care got the best education they could. And she was rewarded. She was rewarded for that by being told that her contract wouldn't be renewed because she set her standards too high, and there was no need to have these high standards for these people who were never really going to do anything except menial and manual work. Now, she didn't give up, and kind of the neat end of her story is that at 65 years old, she was the 4th African-American woman to get a doctorate. She got it from the Sorbonne, where, by the way, she was fluent in French also by that point. And she then lived to be 104. So her story is a powerful one and a one that shows that deep, deep commitment to education for others and for herself. Now, our other person that we're commemorating, whose name has just totally gone out of my mind and I can't find my sheet, Evelyn, what is it? Help me. What? Elizabeth Evelyn. Okay, got it. Anyhow, she also had been born in the middle of the 19th century, and she had the opportunity to attend Tuskegee. Tuskegee was an institution for the education of blacks. And she went there, but she had to work her way through. So she would work during the days, work at night, and then try to take classes during the day. But there was one person who saw her potential. And that person said, "We're going to figure out how you can become a full-time student here." And she did become a full-time student, but it wasn't easy because even there, she encountered prejudice. Not because she was black, but why? She was a woman, exactly. Well, eventually, she opened a school for the children of some of the poor sharecroppers. And it was pretty successful. As a matter of fact, it was so successful that it was burned down. She didn't give up. She started another one. And if I remember correctly, I think it was Firebrand, but she kept going because she was so committed to education as a way of changing life. So hold that in your minds when you hear somebody say, I'm not sure they are really all that interested in education. Oh, yes, we are. Our scriptures tell us the importance of education and teaching in order that we may read the words that tell us how to be faithful followers of Jesus the Christ and to hopefully live into the dream of God. But I want us to remember that in that exhortation to learn and to teach, that it's not a one-way street. Are any of you teachers in here? Okay, so you know that when you teach, yes, you give something to your students, but you get something back, right? Sometimes it's something back you don't want, but you get something back. One of the things that the Episcopal Church, and in some ways kind of its blessing and its curse, is that it's always been really tied to the importance of education. You know, Episcopal schools / Anglican schools are known throughout the world for the outstanding education that they give. And here in this country, the Episcopal Church made sure that everybody, kind of, had an opportunity for education. So the National Church started some schools for African Americans. Now, those schools were started to educate them and also as a way to prepare African American priests to go work in African American congregations. Of course, there was never any thought that they would be going to work in white congregations. But those were, again, a blessing because it was another way for us to get an education. But it hasn't always been good when we've started schools. When I was here in seminary, I noticed that a lot of schools, a lot of the Episcopal schools, especially in Texas and throughout the South, they all were celebrating their 50th anniversary. I thought, oh, that's kind of odd. And then, not being a mathematical genius, it took a while, but eventually I realized, oh, Brown v. Board of Education, 1954. So a lot of people suspected it was coming, and they started what was really segregation academies before the verdict even came down. So we have to be careful about how we pat ourselves on the back about what the Episcopal Church has done. We also have to find ways to open ourselves so that we can, in addition to giving, we can receive, so that we all can be taught. That's easier, of course, said than done. One of the things that I have noticed is that it's pretty easy to say, let me show you how to do something. Because then I get to show you how to do it my way, right? And I feel really good because it's flowing to you. I sit on a board, and we just had this conversation. This board is responsible for helping homeless people figure out how to take each step so that they can become fully self-sufficient. And it's a wonderful thing. But this year was the first time that one of the people who'd gone through the program, and the program's been around a long time, was put on the board. Because there'd always been the sense, we will help them. And then somebody had this great epiphany, he can help us. And at this last meeting, I was saying, you know, my dream is that someday they won't need any well-heeled suburbanites to come and teach this. Those who have gone through and have learned and have been raised up will be the ones who are imparting the knowledge to others. I was talking to Scott this afternoon, and I told him one of the things, this has become a verbal tic, one of the things. I said, I really, really have become convinced that we are at a point where the Episcopal Church and our country has to do some radical changing. We all know what we've heard about over the summer, the events in Ferguson and in Cleveland and in New York, and none of those just started. They've been going on for centuries. We're hearing about them now. But in that, bringing it out into the public, a lot of people are starting to see that the racism that we all wanted to believe was over. Because after all, you know, the Episcopal Church, we did the civil rights thing. We did that in the 60s and 70s, and then we moved on. And then it was the ordination of women, and the prayer book, and the consecration of Jean Robinson. Civil rights wasn't a problem. But now we see it is. And we see that we don't really get each other. And we're finally at a time when maybe we have to ask whether education has to start flowing the other way. Maybe it's time for those who have been so blessed with so many privileges that are easily taken for granted and seen as normative. Maybe it's time to say, how can I learn? How can I be taught? How can I change? How can I learn the lessons that I really do want passed on to my children? Because you see, I don't think that most of the people, at least that I know, really, really, I know they don't want to be racist, they don't want to be prejudiced, but you know what, it's part of our national DNA. We have, you know, everybody has a certain amount of bias, black or white, but those who are white have a privilege attached to it. And it's hard to give up privilege. Very few of us want to give up privilege. I used to teach kids, and I used to talk about global warming. And I'd talk about how, you know, it's really important that we take care of our Earth. And in addition to that, I would teach them about making sure that our goal should be to make sure that everybody could live well. At some point, I realized that what I was really thinking was so that everybody could live like me. Because what I have is just the minimum that anybody needs. So if I could figure out a way, and my students could figure out a way to make sure that everybody in this world could live like me, wouldn't that be great? Wrong. Because the planet couldn't support it. The planet cannot support billions of people living the way all of us do. It means I have to make a decision. I have to decide whether I'm willing to do more than just maybe turning off a light switch and saying this is my thing for global warming, or whether I'm willing to make some radical changes in the way that I live my life. And I'd say that it's also true for how we view each other and how we interact with each other. When I was here in seminary, I was the only African-American person here, which was a real fun place to be. And I was a late vocation, so I was older and tended to speak my mind. But something happened at chapel one day that has always kind of stuck with me. I was a junior. I was sitting in chapel, probably trying to pay attention, and someone got up and said, I have an announcement to make. I want to announce who the sacristans for next year will be. And I kind of sat up and thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder who they are. And I assumed that they must be, you know, probably seniors, and that there had been some process. And to my surprise, it was announced that people in my junior class had been made sacristans. And it was clear that this was a really big honor. Yeah. Let me assure you, I did not want to be a sacristan. I had a kid at home. I just didn't want that. But I sat in one of these chairs, and you don't know me, but you can probably guess I'm rather expressive. And I'm not good at hiding my thoughts, which is why I don't practice law. But I sat there, and I guess my face really showed what I was thinking. And so some of my classmates came to me and said, what was that all about? What, you know, are you mad because they were made sacristan and you weren't? And I tried to explain what was so upsetting to me. And I realized they couldn't get it. So I went to the professor and I said, I've got to talk to you. I've got to tell you that I really, really have a problem with the way you choose sacristans. And again, he thought it was because I was, you know, this was sour grapes. I hadn't been made a sacristan. And I said, no, this probably didn't occur to you because you don't have a lot of others here, but as I sat there and heard you announce that these people had been made sacristans, obviously given this honor, I was like, well, how did they get that? Why did they get that? And my only conclusion was they must have been part of that little good old boy thing that they knew the ins and outs. And so this professor assured me that, no, that wasn't it. It's that we all had been watched all year and that they had chosen the ones that they felt were most fitting for this job. And I said, well, that's nice, but it doesn't work real well for me. It doesn't work real well for me because, again, I don't know what the criteria was. All I know is that you picked a couple of people that you thought were the right people. And I felt excluded, even though I didn't want the job. And I tried to explain that in things like this, you have to have an open process. That if you want a good sacristan, then have an application. Let everybody know. Tell everybody that this is how we're going to do it. And be clear about how you're going to pick that person. And then people like me can take that off our plates. Didn't have to think about, oh, this is one more time that I'm clearly closed out, just as a knowledge stream. I don't know how you choose sacristans now. I hope it's changed. But I want to say that part of the reason that I was so upset about that was also that one of the things that we are learning in seminary is how to run the church. We are learning how to be leaders in the church, right? And so what does that model? If you learn here that it's okay to have this kind of process, then when you go out into the church, into your church, what happens? You've seen that, and you do the same thing. And then we wonder why we have such disparate and often segregated churches. We have to model what we truly do believe, but it means we have to give up something. That was a tradition, and it was a great tradition. And the people who got it, they were excited and happy, and their friends were excited and happy for them. But it wasn't so important that we taught people how to exclude. So we need to remember always that what we do becomes the map for what others do. You're going out into the world to preach the gospel. But when you go out there, make yourselves not just teachers, but also learners. Listen. Wait. Don't be sure that you know that, oh, she wasn't trying to say something racist. You don't know that. And you're taking away from the person who felt that need. Learn to be sensitive to that. And as you do that, as we all do it, as I have places I have to, every human being does, then we're really becoming the people of God who model God's dream and who can then help transform the world. And that's why you're here. You are here not to get some cushy job somewhere. You are here to be teachers of the gospel. You are here to teach people that each and every one of us has worth. Each and every one of us has something to teach and to learn, and that each and every one of us is truly an equal child of God. So, thank you for letting me natter on at you. I will hold you in my prayers as those of you who are leaving leave, and as you go through the rest of your years. And I ask that you hold me in your prayers, and you hold our church in your prayers, because we've got to change. And I believe that with God, all things are possible, and we will change. And with that, let us all say, Amen.